This podcast is also brought to you by Simply Saved Church Security. What do you do when one of your church elders announces that he's been watching Tucker Carlson and is now worried a mob of Black Lives Matter people is going to come and attack your church's statues of white Jesus? What do you do when the leader of your women's circle says during prayer meeting that she is worried about jackbooted government thugs breaking into the church during Sunday worship and forcing at gunpoint everyone to wear masks, just like the Nazis did? You say you don't know what you do? Well, it sounds like you need Simply Saved, the latest in church security solutions. With Simply Saved, our highly trained prayer warriors will demand God place a hedge of angelic protection around your church building. Your holy ground will not be desecrated by your tyrannical local health department or a gang of Antifa invaders. If your church has decided to meet online rather than in person, Simply Saved has you covered there too. Our prayer warriors will save you from Zoom bombings, phishing scams, and computer viruses. A simple monthly subscription to Simply Saved, prorated for the size of your congregation's average Sunday worship attendance pre-COVID-19, will keep your church protected. Let our prayer warriors put your church members' minds at ease when you try Simply Saved today. This is a ministry of Jonah Nightingale Ministries International in Clearwater Beach, Florida. Take a leap of faith with Jonah Nightingale. Hello, Save Me podcast listeners. Hope you're doing all right this summer. I've got to tell you, this pandemic summer has been doing a number on my brain. I've been sticking with work, trying to be present for the family, but it's taken an extreme effort of will to do so. All I really want to do every day, with each and every day bleeding into the next, is turn off my brain and binge TV shows. My pick of choice right now is Orphan Black. Never got to see it before, but I'm digging it. Now, normally, I would be beating myself up about this. Well, I did a bit. Okay, more than a little bit. About this trying to get the podcast episode done. This little project is supposed to be fun, but as always, I can take anything good and use it as a cudgel against my own brain, and so sabotage myself. But I have been trying to do something different. Instead of beating myself up this summer, I've been trying to lean in to just being where I am. When I have sad days, I try to just accept, today I feel sad, and to trust that I will feel different the next day, instead of assuming this is reality and it's never going to get better. I did have a weekend of feeling depressed after I saw the posting from my last church, now looking for a new minister. It was sort of like finding out your ex has begun online dating. But after a few days, I came out of it. Instead of wallowing around in it, I moved on. And that to me seems like progress. I don't know if anybody else out there in the world does similar things, but I recommend to you leaning in to how you're feeling instead of resisting. Maybe it'll save you some pain as well. This summer, I can't decide if it's me or if the usual fruitcakes of Christianity have taken the summer off. I'm not seeing the usual amount of nonsense. I have an old Southern Baptist friend on Facebook who I did see shared something by Franklin Graham saying the media was using COVID-19 to attack Trump. I really wanted to fire off a response, and I almost did, but I ultimately resisted. She's actually a very kind person. I think she's just living in a bubble, and in fact, I think for her, it probably just felt good to share it. And who knows whether she was really invested in that post or not. I still wanted to go off and lose my mind. It would have felt so good to just type out a message and then fire it off. But of course, when I do that, I always feel so bad later on. because I would have had to apologize, and none of it would have changed her mind. In fact, as I'm sitting here talking to you about it, I'm still fighting the urge to not go look up her post and make a response to it. Man, the monopoly that is Facebook clearly has its psychic threads needled into my brain. All I want is the dopamine fix of feeling self-righteous. Which brings me to something I wrote recently for the church I'm working at. I've been writing a daily email, and I'm not sure if anybody reads it, but I'm writing it, and I'm sending it out. I'm hoping that what I wrote might actually inspire somebody to pick up one of the books I'm referencing, read further. Lately, I've been going to my stack of books I've been meaning to read and picking one off the pile and reflecting on it. So given the fact that I want to lose my mind after a stupid Facebook post, there's one I wrote. I think I probably wrote it because I needed to hear it. Maybe you need it too. I titled it, Don't Let Them Get You to Hate Them. Romans 12, 17 through 21 says, Do not repay anyone for evil, but take thought for what is noble in the sight of all. If it is possible, so far as it depends on you, live peaceably with all. Beloved, never avenge yourselves, but leave room for the wrath of God. For it is written, Vengeance is mine, I will repay, says the Lord. No, if your enemies are hungry, feed them. If they are thirsty, give them something to drink. For by doing this, you will keep burning coals on their heads. Do not be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good. Clearly, the Apostle Paul had no idea what social media was, because in the age of Facebook and all the clickety-clack stuff out there that I'm too old to understand, like Snapchat, doing this kind of stuff, man, it hardly makes sense today. In my post, I've been reflecting on the book Almost Everything, Notes on Hope by Anne Lamott. I highly recommend Lamott's writings. I'm a big fan of her memoirs and nonfiction, not so much her fiction. But her nonfiction have meant a lot to me. She's a Christian writer, and she's vulnerable about her own failing, which is a great relief to me because she reminds me I'm not alone with my many screw-ups. A big part of the reason I don't want to read most Christian writers is the self-righteousness and how I walk away feeling worse after having read them. In Almost Everything, Lamott has a chapter titled, Don't Let Them Get You to Hate Them. When I saw the title, I was pretty sure she had written it for me. She laments the increasing levels of hate in our society, coming from all sides, and then she admits to her own difficulties, giving in to the partisan hatred so prevalent right now. If you've been a fan of her writings over the years, she has confessed her hatred for Republicans in general, and some in specific. But in this more recent book, she writes, A friend once said that at the end of his drinking, he was deteriorating faster than he could lower his standards. And this began happening to me recently, with hate. She began to struggle with hate, and so she finally prayed and asked God to help her. God immediately sent two people. The first one was a kid in the Sunday school class she teaches. She writes, I asked one of my Sunday school kids if he believed God was always with him, helping him. He thought about this for a moment and replied, Maybe 40%. 40%? What if I could reduce my viral load of hate by 40%? The second person was Martin Luther King Jr. She saw MLK quoted on Twitter, saying, Hate cannot drive out hate, only love can. As if for effect, her pastor used the same quote in a sermon soon afterward. She writes, I thought I heard it the first time. And then at the end of the sermon, wrapping up, she said, sighing, Just don't let them get you to hate them. I've not been the same since. She ruined hate for me. Lamott continues to struggle with hate, but she accurately describes the effects hate has on us. She says, Hate weighed me down and muddled my thinking. It isolated me and caused my shoulders to hunch, the opposite of sticking together and lifting out our hands and eyes to the sky. The hunch changes our posture because our shoulders slump, and it changes our vision as we scowl and paw the ground. So as a radical act, we can give up the hate and the hunch the best we can. We square our shoulders and lift our gaze. In fact, Lamont writes that instead of viewing people we hate as objects to destroy, we can begin to see people we disagree with and people who are difficult and people who are even our adversaries as, quote, people who are helping you do a kind of emotional weight training, Nautilus for your character. They help us to surrender our hate in the end. As Lamont notes, when we surrender, we hold our palms forward like someone is pointing a gun at you, or palms up as if we're begging for help. Either way, our hands are empty because we have to put down our weapons. For Lamont, and for me, maybe for you too, she reached a point of hating the way hate was making her feel. She was hating the toll hate was taking on her own soul. She writes, hating the way I was feeling helped me give up Camel cigarettes 32 years ago, and then alcohol. It is good to surrender things that poison us and our world. Am I free of such toxicity now? Well, about 40%, and that is a pretty good deal. I'll take it. So, Save Me podcast listeners, I wish you 40% less hate in the coming week. Hey, don't forget to like Save Me Podcast Facebook page or follow us on Twitter at Save Me Podcast 1, the number 1. You can listen on iTunes or Spotify or on my site at anchor.fm. If you would like to support this podcast financially, I'd say first give your money to somebody working for racial justice. And then if you have any left over, you can sponsor the show by going to anchor.fm/save-me-podcast and clicking sponsor. I'm going to have to do something for my current sponsors. I have heard that people do such things. So Ursel, Beth, Ruth, Jeff, and my anonymous contributors know I'm grateful for you and I'm working on something for you. Most of all, you can share this podcast with anybody else you think can handle it. I am an acquired taste and I know this podcast isn't for everybody, so be careful who you share it with, but do share it. Also, please rate and review this podcast on your podcast platform. Apparently that helps people find this podcast. And as much as I've tried to act cool and think I don't want listeners, truth is, I really do. It helps me feel like what I'm throwing out there in the world matters to somebody. It makes me feel less alone. And I see the stats. And when I find out you've listened, it, believe it or not, means a lot to me. One of the ratings I got that I appreciate it by is by Jim BPP. He writes, raw and authentic. Really enjoyed this podcast and the rich blend of humor and wisdom spoken from the heart. Looking forward to more episodes. So Jim BPP, thanks. Thanks for the rating and I appreciate anybody else who can. Just a reminder, I'm speaking to you through a nice expensive microphone given to me by Jimmy Haas of Queens, New York, a member of the youth group I served once upon a time in New York. And it looks like the EP for his band, Mr. Eyeballs, is now out. It's been out for about a week, and the title of it is called Megawet. You can look for it on iTunes and Spotify. Mr. Eyeballs, Megawet. 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 Still sounds gross. On today's show, I will have the first part of an interview with Sonia Van. Sonia is a friend of mine. She is the director of admissions and financial aid at Eden Theological Seminary in St. Louis. It's a United Church of Christ seminary, and she is on the boards of all kinds of organizations, denominational boards and groups, nonprofits. Sonia identifies as an African-American. She prefers black, bisexual woman, and we talk about intersectionality and how she negotiates various spaces with that identity. Pretty sure Sonia was the first person I ever heard use the word intersectionality. And so it turns out she's pretty good at explaining what it means. And it matters a lot right now. Sonia is a longtime resident of the St. Louis. This podcast is also brought to you by Crokesbury Books online store. Are you a dying mainline church in need of transformation without your members having to sacrifice anything or change anything about the way they've done church for the last 75 years? Then Crokesbury Books is the online bookstore for you. We not only sell books, we are the full online resource for all your church supply needs. This summer, COVID-19 prevents churches from holding vacation Bible schools in person, but we at Crokesbury have an online option for VBS that will excite your kids and teach them about God's Word. Try out our new online VBS about diseases of the Bible. Since your kids are learning all about COVID-19 and thinking about disease anyway, why not make a connection with God's Word by talking about diseases mentioned in Scripture? Of course, on the first day of VBS, we will share about the plagues God sent upon Egypt to get Pharaoh to let the Israelites go. Don't worry, we'll skip over that theologically difficult part about God hardening Pharaoh's heart in the first place. No need to explain to young kids that it was all God's fault all along. We'll share how God sent a terrible plague on Egypt's livestock in the field, on Egypt's horses and donkeys and camels, and on Egypt's cattle and sheep and goats. Please note that if your vacation Bible school has some sort of petting zoo planned, this may not be the best day for it. Then we will share how God made festering boils on the flesh of all the Egyptians. We have some great crafts to help kids understand what boils are, thanks to some repurposed Halloween makeup kits. On the second day of Vacation Bible School, we will talk about dysentery and explain how an invasion of the body by bacteria or worms causes stools consisting mainly of mucus, pus, and blood. Dysentery is also accompanied by severe abdominal pain and frequently high fever. When you go number two with dysentery, it's painful because of the irritating effect of the excretions. Hemorrhoids may develop, and at times there is a prolapse of the lower part of the colon. That was the case with King Jehoram of Judah. In 2 Chronicles 21, Elijah the prophet sends a letter to Jehoram criticizing the king for allowing idolatry in the land, which says, "You yourself will be very ill with a lingering disease of the bowels until the disease causes your bowels to come out." It came to pass that the Lord afflicted Jehoram with an incurable disease of the bowels. In the course of time, at the end of the second year, his bowels came out because of the disease, and he died in great pain. It's a good lesson for children to avoid idolatry and to get regular colonoscopies. The kids will have a great time making the craft on this day, where they get to make their very own Jehoram's bladder out of a balloon and pasta sauce. In the book of Job, God makes a wager with Satan that Job will never forsake God. So God allows Satan to kill all Job's animals, and then all his children, and then strike Job with horrible diseases. At one point, Job says, "You have shriveled me up, and it has become a witness. My gauntness rises up and testifies against me." We will explain how this likely refers to atrophy, when your muscles refuse to take in the food a person eats. This is probably caused by polio, which is caught from fecal contamination. We have some great maize worksheets that your little ones can play on to help the fecal matter make it through the maize into Job's mouth. Now, on the next day of VBS, we'll turn to Deuteronomy, where God tells the Israelites that if they disobey his commands, then the Lord will afflict you with the boils of Egypt and with tumors, festering sores, and the itch from which you cannot be cured. We will explain how the itch referred to is probably scabies, which comes from when a female scabies mite digs through the upper layer of skin and makes a burrow for her home. While in that burrow, the scabies mite causes intense itching, especially at night. The victimized person scratches desperately to relieve the itching, frequently digging through the skin and starting serious infections. The scabies mite has a few favorite spots for burrowing. They include the inner surface of the wrist, the lower abdomen, and the tip of the penis. On this day, kids will love their temporary tattoos that look like scabies mites. On the final day, we will end big with a discussion of leprosy, or what is now called Hansen's disease, We will explain how people with the disease can get spongy, tumor-like swellings that grow on the face and the abdomen. The disease becomes systemic and involves the internal organs as well as the skin. Marked deformity of hands and feet occur when the tissues between the bones deteriorate and disappear. Often the sensory nerve endings no longer respond to heat or injury, and the unwary patient may be subject to further destruction of his limb before he realizes danger. Kids will enjoy making their own leprous, spongy, tumor-like swellings with a fun nacho cheese recipe they can make with parents. Order today, now, at crokesbury.edu via our online Bible College bookstore website. We're glad to send you ebooks if you're afraid of catching the coronavirus from your UPS man. Remember, if it's a UPS woman, then lock your door and hide, because she is probably like the prophet Hosea's wife Gomer, who prostituted herself as a part of a divine object lesson to demonstrate how the people of Israel prostituted themselves with foreign gods. And remember, by ebooks, we actually mean photocopies of print book. Facts to you, working fax machines sold separately. Crokesbury is not responsible for the cheap cruise line advertisements that may be faxed to you along with your VBS kit. Try Crokesbury Books today.
A haiku from your priest, poet, and friend, Father Aaron. One thing's consistent. Jesus loves me, this I know. The rest is hazy.
This podcast is brought to you by Zipora Recruiter. We know finding church employees is difficult during the best of times, but it's especially difficult during the economic downturn caused by COVID-19. Your church has gone from not enough qualified candidates to way too many. You may be thinking that the former vice president of a regional restaurant chain would make a terrific church custodian, but how do you know if this person has the spiritual qualifications to work at your church? That former VP may just be faking his conversion story to get the job. His spiritual gifts inventory may be made up just to tell you what you want to hear. That's why you need Zipora Recruiter. It's the only online job site made especially for churches to screen out lukewarm Christians or, God forbid, non-Christians, so you can pick from a list of applicants that are truly letting Jesus carry them along the sandy beaches of life. Just like Zipora, the wife of Moses, she saved him from being attacked by God when she cut off the foreskin of one of her sons and then threw the bloody foreskin at God, saying, "You are my blood father-in-law." Zipora Recruiter, just like the biblical Zipora, saves you from what could be a spiritually deadly mistake. Zipora Recruiter will save you from hiring a pagan or a backslider. Try Zipora Recruiter today. Think of us as your personal bloody foreskin.
My daughter Alina is a high school senior. Soon she'll graduate, in person, not by Zoom. She'll wear a cap and gown and march across a stage. The ceremony must go on. I only wish I could be there to see it. As of now, parents can't attend. Not even with masks or 6 feet apart. They're suggesting we watch from our cars. It's disappointing to miss your child's graduation, but still, life goes on. Jim and I have missed Alina's milestones before: her birth, her baptism, and her first two birthdays were all socially distanced from us. This story is about one of those missed events, the story of Alina's baptism. My daughter Alina has just one baby picture. She's 4 months old, we're told. She smiles in her onesie and pink cardigan with butterfly appliqué. She's held by the hands of an unseen man. She's about to be given away. The man holding Alina was an Orthodox priest. Black vestments sustained the claim. He baptized Alina, lit candles, prayed, immersed her, recited a creed. Then he posed for the camera, evidence required to orphan a baby that day. Alina was born in Dnipropetrovsk, Ukraine, 6 days after 9/11. While Jim and I waited through shock and grief, our daughter was being born. She was born to Irina, who fled the scene. She was born to Maxim, who never met his child. Alina's grandmother brought her home from the hospital in hopes that Irina would return. After months, she gave up on waiting and turned to an orphanage. The orphanage director agreed to take her in, but insisted on baptism first. He explained, if Alina died under his care, christening would shield her soul. So the grandmother did what had to be done. She arranged holy baptism. Then she carried Alina out of God's house back to baby house number 2. She produced the photo which placed her granddaughter into the hands of fate. Her admission ticket, cloaked in fear, her seal of approval from a priest. Then the grandmother left. Alina stayed. She lay blessed and abandoned, Manhasset bound, where soon she'll graduate with the class of 2020, whether I'm there or not. Dear grandmother, don't be afraid. I want you to know she's okay.
Been doing since Ahmaud Arbery and Breonna Taylor and George Floyd? Was it somehow different for you this time, or was it just more heartbreak?
I'm not a native of St. Louis. I'm actually a native of the Kansas City and Lawrence, Kansas area of Missouri and Kansas. But I've lived here for over 30 some odd years, raised my daughter here. And I can pretty much say that I'm a St. Louisan because I've spent the majority of my life here. And that time has mainly been spent in the North St. Louis area. So went to school and pretty much was only about 4 miles away from Ferguson my entire life, right? And so when Ferguson did happen, I was actually in my last year of seminary at Eden Theological Seminary, and I had been recovering from cancer, to be honest with you, and had to extend my 3-year commitment of being in seminary to a 4-year commitment, which I was really, really upset about. Let me just say that. I was angry because I was trying to get up out of there, right?
Some of us took 4 years for seminary and we didn't have cancer.
Right. Okay. Well, I had a goal. And if you know anything about me, I'm very goal oriented. And so it was upsetting and it was difficult. I had to really spend some time getting quiet with myself. Mm-hmm. And then right before school began, Ferguson happened.
Yeah.
And it was also my daughter's first year in college. She went away to college, by meaning she lived on campus, but she lived on campus literally across the street from Eden. She wanted to protest and she wanted to be a part of it. And Eden was very much involved with it. And so I felt a really strange way because for the first time in my life, I couldn't just run out there and do what I wanted to do, which is to protest, to be a part of it. I had to sit back because I was recovering from, I had thyroid cancer, so it was even 10 times worse trying to breathe all that air in.
Oh, yeah.
Right. So the long and the short of that was that moment for me, it was always a surreal moment. And as I got healthier, that I was able to go out and participate. And so I was a peacekeeper during that time. So that was really real to us. And we can go by there. And I do a lot of race reconciliation work and a lot of education work around that time and what happened. And if you know anything about this area, you know it was a quiet storm building up. There were a lot of things that led up to that moment over the course of maybe, you know, it was a course of a lifetime, but really in particular, maybe about 5 to 6 years prior, there was a tornado that came through the airport and also hit Ferguson and wiped out very much of the poor areas of Ferguson. There was a huge economic downshift and just a lot of things that were going on in that area. So fast forward now, you know, we've gone through Ferguson, we're 6 years out of that, and nothing changed. I think that I personally have a moment of PTSD every single time I see a video. But what was so in particularly difficult about George Floyd, and let me even go before, you know, there was George Floyd and there was Ahmaud Arbery right there together for me in many ways. I can't, to be honest with you, I know that I know the timeline, but as far as I'm concerned, they happened within a couple of days of each other because of the way that the videos, tapes came out. And they were so horrific. I think they were horrific in the way in which I imagine Trayvon Martin, right? The way that I've seen Tamir Rice, the way that I've seen Eric Garner, all of those. And then on the heels of that, we get Dominique Remy, who was the transgender woman as well. And then we get Breonna. I mean, it was almost suffocating. And for me, what made it so horrible was that I was sitting here in complete isolation in my office, plugged to the television, watching the news because the coronavirus has been so real for me and my congregation that hit. And I was so unprepared for it. More where I was prepared for the fact that I know that we're struggling to still get the world to understand that Black lives don't matter, right? In this country especially, but apparently all over the world, right?
Right.
But now, when that happened and I realized that we were already under the throes of this pandemic that further emphasized Black Lives Matter and the movement itself, then, oh my gosh, in the midst of all of this, we're still, it's bad enough we're trying to fight a pandemic, but then it's, and I just think that for the first time, I was so unprepared that I shut down.
Yeah.
And most of the time when things happen, I look for conversation partners and I look for people who help reframe me so I can get myself back together. For the first time in probably my lifetime, other than probably the death of my father, I allowed myself to wallow in it and to feel it and to be hurt and be disenfranchised and to be angry. And I just worked. And so that was something I really needed to do because I had not been allowed to do that, or I didn't allow myself to do that since Mike Brown, because I have always been a person who's been welcomed in to have conversation about justice work and reconciliation work, that you're too busy trying to put together what your next talk is going to be.
Sure.
And in the middle of that, I just decided, I don't really want to talk to anyone. I don't want to help white people feel this, because if you cannot look at this man's knee on this gentleman as he was literally losing life and before our very eyes, then I can't explain this to you. There's nothing I can do to make this more real for you or to put this into context. I think that was the difference. The difference for me is that I decided that I did not have to sacrifice my Black body for other people to get it. And then, lo and behold, here comes this multi-generational, primarily here in St. Louis, white protest movement. Mm-hmm. And I say primarily, that's the number, the count of people. And for the first time, they're allowing, I shouldn't say for the first time, but Black people and young people are leading the conversation, and you don't have, and white people are following saying, yeah, that's wrong. And I'm not saying that that didn't happen before, but now you really see it. And it's not just happening in little pieces here in St. Louis and Minneapolis, it's happening around the world. And I literally just broke into complete tears when I saw the Maori clan doing their war
dance. Yeah.
And I was like, wow.
Well, it sounds to me like you needed to allow yourself to grieve and to feel it, you know, to take care of yourself. Because in the past, you've been go, go, go.
Always.
Which is what I think of you anyway, is go, go, go. So I think you were probably due. What I'm seeing a lot of Black folks write about is that the videos are traumatizing.
Yes. Yes. You know?
And it is literally capital T trauma.
It is. You know,
to watch these. I don't want to be the white man co-opting other people's pain. I have two black sons that are adopted and shared about how they're both bigger than me now. And so they're not cute little boys anymore. All I could see when I looked at George Floyd was one of my sons. The only reason I'm not going insane right now is I'm white. Really don't have any lived experience of what it's like to face this every day. I haven't lived this. If I had lived this all my life, I think I can't imagine the toll this would be taking on me. I would never let my children leave my sight, I think. Yeah. I can't imagine what it's like to be black, to somehow have resilience when you face this all the time.
I think you really are speaking to the heart of the matter. I'm not a person who easily fears for my own life. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that's just blind stupidity or blind faith, or maybe a combination of the two. But my daughter, right? I think that you talk about young men, and I think that that's definitely a big part of this, because that's the fear mechanism in this situation, definitely. Right. But I think that we also, for me as a mother of a young woman, and my daughter's a little thing, right? She's only like 5'3", so she's a little petite thing. And I really have been more conscientious of her wokeness in this moment. Yeah. The fact that she doesn't realize that she's a little thing, right? She's a big brain with a lot of feistiness.
Right.
And I so worry about her, because I know what it is to be in the middle of a protest, everything just go to heck, right? Yeah. And it goes to heck like that, just a blink of an eye. Her very first year, I banned her from protesting. And I thought that was the big deal, right? But then I'm starting to think she could be in her home.
Yes.
She could be driving in the car. And yes. I will say this to you. I've been arrested before, and it was just, you know, silly stuff. Oh, you have an outstanding warrant. Well, you get there, and then I find out after I've already been, had to change into an orange jumpsuit, had to be stripped, searched, and having searched, and put into a cell with other people, and urinated, and I mean, this, just be honest about that, right? After that, it was, oh, well, there was a mistake in our system.
Yeah.
That's happened to me, right?
Yeah.
And it was a really interesting thing, because there were two people there, and it was a guy who was in training. And I asked the guy, I said, so why did you pull, what was the purpose for you pulling me over? I had nothing, there was nothing wrong. He said, well, your car resembled a car that we were looking for.
Oh my gosh.
Then his boss goes, and we got lucky, right? And I'm just like, you know, and it was one of those moments. And I'm talking about before Mike Brown, before anything and everything. And so I know it happens. And the only reason why it didn't escalate, and I'll be honest with you, is I have a little modicum of privilege, which is I have attorneys who, because of what the work that I do, I can pick up and make a phone call. And my wife at the time was a physician.
Yeah.
So I was very much a person who had some access. And while I'm sitting in that jail cell, I'm having conversations with people who had been there for 13 days already, just going to stay there and work their time off until they were literally sent to the next jail cell. And I'll be honest, I didn't understand how that was, but I am now one of those people who, my daughter, I'm very careful with making sure that all of her stuff is in order, because at the very least, they can never, ever do something like this to you. But I realize it doesn't matter anymore, because you can be a Sandra Bland, you can be a Breonna Taylor, and be at home or be in your car after an interview and feeling great about yourself, and all heck just, you know, everything just goes to pieces. And I just don't want to belabor the fact that it's not young men only that I'm concerned about. As the sister of a black man in Atlanta right now, my brother, my baby brother is in Atlanta, and I want to pick up the telephone and be like, okay, are you okay, every single day of my life. I used to have this thing about my daughter about checking in, and I want him to check in with me, but I know he's a grown man, right?
Right.
But the fear is real. It's so real even now that I actually had a panic attack because of COVID, I couldn't go in and get my license tags renewed. And so it took longer because I had to do it over the internet, and then they had to mail them to me. I refused to go anywhere for 2 weeks until they came. And I'm not talking about I had already been expired. I'm talking about from literally the end of May until the 15th of May. I refused to go anywhere because my tags expired at the end of May. I was just fearful. And that's recent. That's real. And I think that the shift is that we're so concerned, and we have been so concerned and been protesting Black bodies, and in particular Black male bodies. But I am now of the understanding that all Black bodies are in jeopardy their lives are in jeopardy because there's no filter anymore for those who carry guns, for those who are legally able to carry guns or otherwise to take their lives.
Terrifying.
It is.
And not just sons and daughters, but Sonia, I'm a white, straight, cisgender man. I try to remain educated, but I'm slow a lot of times. And you were one of the first people I can remember using the word intersectionality. Mm-hmm. I can remember hearing you use that word and going, I've heard that word. I think I know what that means. I need to figure out what that means. Do you mind? Is it too personal to talk about what it means to be? I don't know whether you identify as lesbian or queer or what languages you use.
Let's talk about this, right? So I identify as an African-American. I prefer the word Black, bisexual woman. And in our world, I would consider myself to be a femme. So I love girly stuff, right? Uh-huh. But I have been very public about the fact that I don't allow people to give me one identifying mark, right? I want to represent all of them for what they are in my life, which is part of who I am as a whole, but also individually, each one of those is who I am in many ways, right? Mm. And so for me, as far as intersectionality, at the very core of who I am is a Black woman. I knew I was Black from the day I knew anything about myself, right? Growing up predominantly in Atlanta, Georgia, in the 70s and early 70s, and my father was a project manager engineer. We lived in a predominantly white area. I just remember the fact that my next door neighbor could come in my house and play with me, but I was not allowed in her home. And that was a big deal, right? And finally, my father got to the point of stay away from that yard. It was the last part of it because I guess something had happened. And I still to this day don't even know what that was, but something had happened. And that was one thing. The other part of it for me was coming of age moment for me in my 30s when I realized, okay, so the thoughts I've been having are not like everybody else's thoughts. And this is actually an identity of my sexuality, right? And identified and came out as a bisexual woman. At that point, I realized, okay, wow, there's another layer of me that I wasn't even aware, but darn it, I have to give credence to it. And that was important. So it was so important that I was in the middle of ministry and going through an ordination process with a denomination that I left because I couldn't serve in that denomination is wholly who I believed myself to be at that point. And then, of course, I'm a woman. And I think that to me, as much as I say, okay, I identify myself as a female, I don't know if I identify myself as fully, wholly woman until recently. And that's only because I've come into womanist theological thought and practice to the point where I so understand why I get outraged about things and why, where other people would come in and say, oh, this or that, whatever, but I would always come with some kind of other kind of snappy, audacious, kind of bold statement around things, why I like to wear my hair a certain way and why I like to do certain things. It's because I'm this womanish thing that nobody has ever been able to put their finger on, but I identified that in myself. And it's funny because I think the intersectionality, this idea that all of us can't just be one identity only. And as much as you might say, I'm a white cisgender man, you're a white cisgender man from the South. You know, there's all these different parts of you that make up the intersection of who Chase is. And so for me, that's part of it too. And because of that, I'm very serious when I say that people are like, well, oh, we didn't know you were gay. Well, you know, we didn't know you were bisexual. Well, how were you supposed to know? I don't talk to people and demand that people tell me what their sexual identity is or what their sexual orientation may be. I walk up to people and take them for who they present as, right? And as they reveal things to me, then that's how I know. And so I have really had a hard time explaining to people who felt like I offended them by not letting them know my fullness. And I just don't know how many people had to come out as heterosexual. I just don't know. To be honest with you, I don't know anybody who had to come out as heterosexual. And when I was heterosexual, I didn't have to come out as heterosexual. I identified as such. Now that I identify as a bisexual Black woman, I really find that I don't allow people to put me in a box. I want to be that intersection. And in different places where you meet me, you might see me present a different way because it depends. I could be a businesswoman here. I could be an activist here. I could be a minister here. But in all of those, all of them are fully present, but you may see different parts of me. And I think that's what's so hard for people to understand, right? It's almost like you know, because you identify as LGBTQIA, that should be the thing that walks out the door first every day,
yeah.
and then you bring everything else with you. But intersexuality says that all of those things come with you, and you might meet them in different places at different times.
Do you feel a greater sense of vulnerability that you're not just Black, but you're also bisexual? Because you have experienced, I mean, you mentioned, I don't know what denomination you were a part of before, mm-hmm. but you've been in spaces having your sexual orientation put you outside. You were excluded, even cast out. Do you feel like it increases your vulnerability somehow?
So I'm just unapologetic, right? This is just part of me that's very much a Jeremiah Wright type of unapologetically Black, bisexual. So let me just say, to answer your question, I don't initially, until I'm aware that it's their problem, right?
Right.
And then my response is not to shy away from it, but to stand my ground in many ways, right? This idea of bold and sometimes brass, right? But at the very core of me is a desire to, I think, be understood without having to apologize for who I am. And I think that if anything comes out with me, that's probably it, that I'm going to speak my truth. And I think it's funny when I agree with some people and they don't expect me to agree, it shocks the heck out of them because they automatically think I'm going to have some opposing view because I might be seemingly more liberal than their conservative value, right, of me.
Yeah.
And so I think it's shocking, but sometimes it's fun, but at other times it can be very frustrating. And I try not to let that get the best of me. At the very core of me is to be true to who I am. Yes, Lord knows I've had some problems because of it, but I don't know if I can ever put my finger on that one thing. I don't know if it's because I'm a woman. I don't know if it's because I'm bisexual. I don't know if it's because I'm Black. There's so many parts of me that could be oppressed at any time.
Right.
I don't know which one it is that they're oppressing at that time. Maybe they're just taking them all and saying, oh, we have lots of reasons to deal with her, you know? But I also present, I'm 5'10", right? So it's really hard to oppress a 5'10 woman who's sure of themselves. And I think that gets me in the room and gets people off my back for the most part, at this point in my life, at least.
I also should clarify for people who don't know you, you also have the biggest smile about anyone I know. And so, I would describe you as bold and even brash at times, but I also think of you as kind, very approachable as well.
Thank you. I appreciate that. I've been raised predominantly in very multicultural spaces, predominantly white spaces. And it wasn't really until we moved to St. Louis when I was in middle school that I went to a school that was predominantly Black. And so I think for that reason, not that I was a jokester, I've always been a serious student, but my way of disarming people has always been to be kind. Right? If all else fails, be kind. Even when they're not being kind, be kind. My mother has this thing about me that, you know, I come from a family that has the gift of gab. But the truest part of it is I think in my heart and my soul is that I'm a diplomat, that I'm always trying to figure out where we can find common ground. But as I've aged, I've realized that that's not always a reality. And so where can we have an understanding of respect? It's my thing. And so I think you're right. I appreciate the fact that people don't feel so challenged at first, but normally that goes away as soon as I open my mouth.
Well, I'm not trying to say you're a wilting flower or something. Mm-hmm. I'm just saying I always felt like when you were taking a stand on something, there was a context that you'd already laid. It wasn't like, oh, here's Sonia again. It was like, no, she's already shown that she can listen.
Mm-hmm.
You know, to a point of view that she may not agree with. And so you gave that respect first.
I appreciate that. I think that what that comes from for me is that my paternal family was raised in the Church of God in Christ, and my mother was a missionary Baptist. And so I found myself in more conservative ways growing up in a very conservative way of thinking. And so much so to the point that I never came out to my father. So he passed away without ever knowing. I've distanced myself for the most part from the paternal side of the family. I mean, I still talk to them. We're friends on Facebook. But my life is not up for debate. And so if that's the only way that we can come together is for you to debate my life, then we don't need to do that.
Right.
So that's one part of it. But I realized that those experiences, and even going to, when I decided to go into ministry, I went back to school and got a degree in Christian education from a very conservative school that wouldn't even allow women to preach. And so when I demanded to be a part of preaching class, and I told them that I would have to call Title IV, because I know a little bit about that, on them, and if they didn't allow me, so they let me do it. But they wouldn't let me preach from the pulpit, and I had to preach from the floor. Okay, fine, whatever. I like to move around anyway. I got done, and I got a B minus in that class, right? He just refused to give me anything. He wanted to give me, he didn't want me to fail, but he was going to give me a B minus, and I knew he was going to give me that to begin with, right? But I think, so I say all that to say that I come from disagreeable circumstances where I knew that my very existence could be an abomination to those people, and I was a heresy in many ways, right?
Right. And so, even before you were bisexual.
Right.
And so, when I want to preach.
Exactly. So, when I came into knowing myself, I knew why I had to stand my ground on those and really say to people that this goes back to intersectionality. When I didn't even know every point at which I was truly intersecting, the things that I was aware of, those things were the things that I stood for and said, no, I'm not going to move. So, it's just been a part of who I am. But it's always been with respect until all respect broke down. And then I would pretty much say, okay, so at the end of it, this is where I am. And I'm not going to allow you to belittle me or to demean me because I know who I am. And I find that to be the thing where people kind of go, what the heck? Because they don't do that very often.
Right. Speaking of that, I mean, you've been in the UCC for some time now, United Church of Christ. Lost track of your position at Eden Seminary. Are you director of admissions now?
I am the director. That's recent. I'm director of admissions and financial aid now.
Okay. You're big time now, admissions and financial aid. As a refugee who came into the United Church of Christ, what has bothered me all along is you have this very progressive denomination. On the one hand, that I felt glad that there was space for me, right? Like I'm no longer the most liberal person in the room when I was Baptist. When I read news and if there's a faith response to a social justice issue, usually the UCC, at least the national, is involved. Mm-hmm. But then it is one of the widest denominations ever. That has a lot to do with its history, mm-hmm. right? But it still is super white, and they've made a lot of efforts at inclusion and that kind of thing. But you move from a much more black religious space to a very white religious space.
Yeah.
And was that jarring for you?
It was so jarring for me. Yeah. So I went, it's really funny because I've never thought about it until you just said it the way you did. I went from the blackest denomination you could probably get, which is the African Methodist Episcopal, right? It literally was founded on a walkout by a black man from a church, right?
Yeah.
So that's about as black as you can get as a denomination. And I went to one of the whitest denominations in proportion, right? And the funny thing is I went from a bit more conservative to a more liberal. And it's confusing as heck.
Well, it is.
But I will say this, I came to the United Church of Christ because I was a refugee, as you said. I like that word because that's true, because I needed to go someplace where I was fully accepted as a bisexual woman who was in the process of marrying another woman.
Right.
And so I had already decided I was going to Eden Theological Seminary, which is a school of the United Church of Christ. But I didn't know one of my good friends and who's now my pastor was attending Eden and had just recently graduated from Eden or was in the process of it. And I didn't know that they were in United Church of Christ school. I ended up looking for the United Church of Christ because I was looking for places that were LGBTQIA friendly.
Sure.
And I did a Google search. And so I started going to those congregations. Every congregation I went to was a predominantly white congregation. And it was sort of like, wow, I want to do this thing, but can I do this thing, right? Can I do all of this? Because if I'm nothing else, I love worship. I am a worshiper, and I love the freedom of worship, but I do it in a very Afrocentric Black way, right? That's what I'm accustomed to. I mean, I'm a person who knows hymns by heart because that's what I was taught in my grandmother's knee. You know, there's things about me that are just a part of who I am, and they're sung a certain way, right? So I walk in, and I kept going and dragging my fiance and my daughter with me, and they were like, if you must do this, we'll go with you. But it was a really tough thing. And so what happened was that we were searching, and the person who's my pastor now ended up being called to a United Church of Christ church. So she was formerly AME too, and ended up being called to a United Church of Christ church. And her first day, we decided we'll go, because we were like, if Tracy can do this, then we might be able to do this too, right? And lo and behold, if the church that she was being called to happened to be the church that was right around the corner from the house that I was raised in. Wow. Okay. And so, but it was a predominantly white church at that time, but that's where she was called to. And now it's a predominantly Black church.
I didn't know that. I thought it had always been an African-American church.
No. It had started out as a all white church, and slowly through desegregation and integration and so forth, became a Black church until, to be honest with you, a schism caused all the white members to leave, and they left behind the Black members. So these are black people who wanted to be a part of a white church, who are now an all Black church, which is a very interesting history in and of itself.
Well, and I should add here real quick for the listener, your friend Tracy you're speaking of is Tracy Blackman.
Right.
And the church you're speaking of, why have I gone blank on the name?
Christ the King United Church of Christ. King.
Yeah, I should know that. Tracy is now on the national staff for the United Church of Christ and still the pastor. Many people got to know Tracy and became aware of Tracy after Mike Brown was killed in Ferguson. Right. Christ the King is in Florissant, which is what, next door?
Yeah, 4 miles.
My other question for you about that transition, I have routinely in my ministry been approached by white and Black folks coming from more conservative denominations who are, you know, LGBTQ, and they are doing what you did, which is they Googled, you know, and found a denomination that would have them. Mm-hmm. I've had some painful experiences, actually, with folks who joined the church I was serving, got involved, even helped them begin the ordination process. And then it would come out that really deep down, theologically speaking, they were still the conservative denomination that they came from. They were still AME, or they were still whatever. And if that denomination would have them, they would still be there. It ends up not being a fit. It's like, just because you're LGBTQ doesn't mean that you're a theological fit, you know, for the United Church of Christ. Was there a time for you of dissonance, of experiencing a more liberal theology, or was that helped because you found a church that fit your style?
Well, you know, let's be honest, first and foremost, and all kidding aside, I found a Black UCC church. I did not find an open and affirming church.
Right.
So I went to several open and affirming churches that were all white or predominantly white. But the church that I felt most at home, even in the midst of what I just left, was a church that still struggles with my sexuality. That's a very interesting piece. And so I will say that in many ways, my theology has always been progressive. I just didn't have words for it. And I don't have a high Christology, but I do lean in that direction in my faith talk. So that's one part that resonates, I think, with this congregation. But with me, in particular, in the denomination, the United Church of Christ to me is a very interesting conglomeration of people who are sort of misfits or from other denominations who come, and that becomes who we are in many ways. So I find that almost anything goes, except for, you know, violent acts, of course. Right. But a lot of things go if you thoroughly understand the theology of it.
Yes.
And so I've been very good at making sure that I understand, especially because I work for Eden, right? It's really important that I have an understanding of who I am and articulate that. And so I try to keep that very clear. And the areas where I'm still gray and functioning and trying to figure it out, because I do believe in the still speaking God, I will say those are the areas where I'll be honest and say, you know, I'm still trying to deal with this whole idea of blood and everything, because it's such a real, to be honest with you, I'm pushing back. I have so many people who are talking about, you know, atonement theology. And I'm like, I hear you. I really do. But you don't have a problem feeling Black blood for the sake of whiteness, right? So there is some atonement in that process. And let's be honest, you're talking about a brown Palestinian Jew, who, not a white blue-eyed Jesus here.
What?
So I'm pushing back. And just like they pushed me, I think I've learned to push back and challenge them, because I want to, you know, this goes even back to a little bit of the intersectionality. I think that the Jesus we bring with us is built primarily on our readings of the Bible and our perceptions of humanity. And if you are a person that has lived in white privilege with little to no struggle for you, it's really easy for you to throw away the blood of Jesus, right? The blood that gives me strength from day to day. I sing that every first Sunday because I don't know any other thing that really defines to me why the table and the altar are so important to me. But yet and still, if I did that in a white denomination or a white, congregation, they would look at me like, you're talking about the blood? Oh my God, I'm like, you know what? Do you know how many Black people lose their lives? And it's not a pretty fainting death. I'm talking about blood because of shooting and killing and murders that happen in the streets. I said, blood, for the sake of you all to get the attention and to hear us is important, right? That's the only thing. It wasn't until people were spraying young children and literally injuring them that people said, oh, we got to stop this in the 60s. This is horrible. It wasn't until we saw someone lose their life and Michael Brown's body literally laid out for almost 4 hours bleeding to this day where that area is literally covered because the blood soaked in the ground of the concrete. Okay. Mm-hmm. That blood has power. And I think that, you know, if we're going to talk about the theology shifts or lack thereof, this denomination suffers around being so liberal that they have lost sometimes the ability to be real.
Sure. I know what you're saying about, blood in terms of, in my experience, I grew up Southern Baptist. And as my theology changed, I was like, I can't wait to be like in a progressive church. We're going to really do social justice, right? Mm-hmm. That I got to do in a more conservative church. And the shocking thing for me was to be in a church full of white liberals and to discover white liberals think they have done something if they've studied and talked about it. And like, it's done. We talked about it, didn't we? And it's like, no, now's the time where we hit the streets, go out and work for change. And it was like, well, what do we need to do that for? And I feel like an issue within this liberal denomination is, largely white liberal denomination, is one is privilege is still a thing where you can retreat to a safe space where it's just an abstract idea. It's not a matter of life and death for you. And then there's just this sense of it's all of the mind. It's all cerebral and it's not of the heart and the body. And the faith so often to me is so very disembodied. I knew what it was to have a faith that had no brain, that did not love it, did not love God with its mind. That was Southern Baptist. And then I came to the UCC and I feel like, well, we only love God with our mind. I don't know if you felt that way.
I do. It's not just a white thing. That's the thing I think is interesting that I have found in my own congregation that the more educated you become and the more ability you have to have some power around intellect, the more you want to reason the ins and the outs of others, right? Or how far your what faith really is. If you start to get a definition of it, does that lessen it, right? And I tell you the truth, Chase, I have actually started to reconsider what people used to tell me. Oh, you go to seminary and it ruins your call. It ruins the divine in you, right? And that used to be a part of the Kojic faith and the Baptist faith, this idea that a learned person was a dangerous person, right? And this idea of studying scripture to preach it when you should be praying over it and that it should come that way. I think that what I have done for myself is found a happy medium, but for my denomination and for the local people that I deal with more intensely, I find that compassion and being forced out of their comfort zone does more than this idea of study, right? So, because they're really big on book studies. It drives me crazy with you. And I don't get me wrong, I love to read, but I think you're so right that that is a big part. So one of the things that I did in 2017, so after I graduated from Eden, which was 2015, I started working because I never really decided permanently if I wanted to pastor a church or if I wanted to work in supporting the church in other ways. And so I started doing some things and I ended up at Eden so I could create a new degree program. While I was there, a church that was down the street from Eden, which was it's a very wealthy, all-white congregation, their pastor was going to go on sabbatical. And they decided that I was the good fit for the sabbatical at that time. Now, ended up being asked to come to this church, and I told them no the first time. I told them no the second time. Finally, they asked me to come in for a meeting, and I sat down, and they said, you know, we've all prayed about it, and we want you to be our sabbatical pastor. Oh, my goodness. And I went and had to go pray about it then, too. And it just so happened that it ended up being the best thing I ever did for almost 5 months of my life. And what made it really good was not because every day I walked in there thinking this was great. It was because one day I had prepared this sermon. That sermon just so happened to be about Joseph the Dreammaker. Charlottesville had happened that Saturday. And my pastor, Tracy, was on the news and doing a national interview. And I'm watching it. You know, I don't know if I was like pressing clothes, getting ready for Sunday. I don't know what I was doing. But she comes on and she's talking to Joy Reid. And all of a sudden, there's like all this gunfire. And they just rip her off of the screen. And we don't know where she is at. So we are frantically, when I say we, with the ministerial staff here, is frantically texting. Do you know what's going on? Oh, my gosh. You know, her security detail took her for protection because they didn't know what was happening. But it took us a while to figure out if she was OK. That was the most fearful moment I think I had ever imagined, because up until that point, I was in a situation where I could only imagine what Jesse Jackson, what Abernathy and King had gone through, and the really close people to him had gone through. And at that moment, it became real for me that that could happen that quickly. And it really caused a huge shift in me. So the next day, that sermon went out the door, and I came down out of the pulpit, and I took a chair, and I sat down, and I said, can we talk?
Mm-hmm.
And I just, I won't say I bled them, but I said to them that we are in, and I used the scripture that we had that day, but God had really been wrestling with me that night. Tonight, it was a sleepless night. And I just told them that if we were to look at the lives that we lead right now, Black people are Joseph in the cistern. And it wasn't anyone other than his brothers. So I'm looking at my brothers and sisters in Christ, and I'm looking at you all and going, it's not because of my enemy that Black people are in this right now. It's because the people who say they love us won't actually get us out of here.
Mm.
And I told them, I said, I literally watched someone who I love, my pastor, who I've known since my daughter was 3 years old at this point. At that point, my daughter was in college. And I didn't know what happened to her. I didn't know if they had shot her. I didn't know if they were trying to shoot her. I didn't know. And what I didn't want to be is a friend of a person who was martyred. I didn't want to be a person who had to figure out how to mourn in public, because this is now a public figure. I didn't want to be that person. I wanted to be the person who is part of the staff of that person. And I realized I could not be that person at that point because I'm a Black woman who has Black friends whose lives are constantly in jeopardy. Why? Because we have a dream. We have a dream that one day God's plan for humanity will really be so. And what I find is that we don't have enough people who dream like us. And so we find ourselves put in these holes, right? In these dark, stank holes constantly. Sometimes they're permanent holes because Mike Brown is dead. Sometimes they're temporary holes because people get wounded, right? Sometimes there are holes that we can't get ourselves out of, like prisons and, juvenile. I mean, there's holes that we've built for Black people in this country, right? And until you all who wanted me here, right? I didn't come to you and knock on your door and say to you, can I come and be your pastor for 5 months, right? You asked me to be here. So that means you're going to have to deal with me. And I realized that up until this moment, I wasn't letting you really see me. And so today, I'm sorry, I can't be anything but me and tell you I'm hurting. I'm in pain. And until you deal with the fact that you all live in a world that was created by the hands of my forefathers, and you benefit from that, that I don't know if I can do this anymore. And that was a huge shift. And what I regret is that a Black person had to do that for them to get it. But I realized that I had built up enough credit, right? Enough street cred at that point them that I could do it. And from that point forward, everything changed. It really did. And I'm really proud of them. I'm proud of what they were able to accomplish, but I regret that I had to bleed for them to do it.
Yes.
And so that's the thing that bothers me. I think that again, going back to the atonement theology, because they don't want to see the blood, it's so offensive, right? Oh my right. God. It's so offensive that, and they want to sterilize Jesus, the very body of the person who was assailed by hate. That's why it's so hard for denominations, white denominations, to get this. And maybe that atonement, and not so much in the idea that it had to be by this way, because it didn't have to be that way for everyone to get it. You could have just gotten it. You could have just understood that the world is not the way it is because God said it should be this way, but the world is the way it is because we created the world this way. Every day when we choose to not be a part of it. So I so agree with you that there's a huge difference, but I think that in our inability to identify our hands and the messiness of our hands, we want to wash it off like Pontius Pilate, right? That we have decided to sterilize a really messy story, and that's why we don't get it. That's why the church is struggling at this point.